Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for tales and related discussions, internet style.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. This week, we start our villains arc by taking a look at the comical, the sympathetic, and the downright creepifying with the Santarans, the Silurians, and the Angels. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten. This team can just write pretty much anything, and we're just going to be like, oh, that's awesome. And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect two-hand name.
And Keir Hansen.
I'm holding up for cat fight.
Welcome to episode 25 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where tonight we celebrate the suspense, the horror, and the occasional hilarity of potatoes, geckos, and decorative sculptures as the villains to our favorite Time Lord. We wanted to take a couple of weeks to, similarly as we've done with our companion arc, to take a look at the other side of the coin and look at some of the antagonists that have been put up against our beloved Doctor. And this week, keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer, we decided that we were going to take a couple of the races, species, categories that we've seen recurrent through not only Modern Who, but Classic Who as well, in two out of the three cases we'll be discussing tonight. We'll see what kind of a backstory we can pull together. Joining me as always is the lovely and voluptuous Jay.
Not where I expected you to go with that one. How's it going?
And the burly and sensual Melissa.
Hello.
So tonight, just to give a sort of an advance notice, we'll do our typical news recap for the night. But for those of you who are keeping track at home, because we did get some suggestions across the Twitter sphere for when they did catch wind of the fact that we were going to be talking villains, and had some interesting suggestions along the way. We'll try to get to ones that we think warrant some good discussion because of their weight or impact on the Hooniverse over the years and over the decades. Tonight, though, specifically, we're going to be taking a look, in no particular order, at the Silurians, the Santarans, and just to keep things creepy as hell, the Weeping Angels. So that's tonight's docket. But why don't we get some news out of the way? We got some interesting stuff to talk about tonight.
Yeah, we've got some really big stuff going on, actually. It was announced this week that the 50th anniversary special is actually going to be broadcast in 3D in some selected theaters.
Yes.
BBC announced that they are going to be picking out random cinemas. They're not random. I'm sure there's a reason for them. But, they're going to be picking out cinemas and actually broadcasting this in 3D. It's not the first BBC production to be in 3D, but it's certainly the biggest one. What that means for us here in the States, I don't know. They haven't said anything about us so far, but
right. I mean, this is just still a bubbling topic on the other side of the pond. So mm-hmm. They'll get some logistics figured out. They'll get people all up in a tizzy about it, and then all the 3D theaters will show up in Kent. So everybody else will be SOL. It's a nice move. It's a bold move. I think it's good to see.
And I would absolutely love this. I mean, there's down here we've got the theater, the Alamo Draft House, which specializes in some of the special screening kind of things. You know, they do little gimmicks and little and stuff that's not been in theaters for years and things like that. So this would be right in their wheelhouse. And I would love to see this, if for no other reason than just to go out and watch this with a theater full of other Whovians. I mean, there's not a better environment that you can get into.
Well, I think, again, and this is going to go along with the fact that it leads me to believe that they're going to be doing a lot more with this one sort of cornerstone special. You know, we knew that we were going to be handed all kinds of little bits and pieces and little gifts along the way as we were, you know, rounding out the year here. But we wanted to know what they were going to be doing with the big event. And if it's of the caliber and of the scale that they can do this sort of distribution with it, then it's really going to be something to see, no matter which side of the pond you're on.
Well, also, we didn't even know if there would be a one big main event. You know, this is confirmation that there's going to be an episode. True. You know, it's great that it's in 3D and be shown in theaters, but I'm just happy that, like, they're doing one big 50th anniversary.
Yeah, there's finally a set, like, yes, definitely, this is what's going on kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Similarly, with the lead-in to the 50th, we have our second installment in BBC America's productions they've been doing as their sort of, call it a primer, I guess, as they walk through the Doctors and present us with some sort of iconic episodes that go along with each. We had a great experience last month with what they did with William Hartnell and leading into the Aztecs as they did this little... I don't know what you want to call this sort of a bumper special called The Doctors Revisited. Great interviews. I really loved, I mean, we referenced this last week as we were talking about some of, you know, Tennant's contributions to the interviews discussing the First Doctor and the importance of the groundwork being laid there. Also some great stuff from Steemo that came along with that episode or that little installment. We've got the next one that's going to be coming along on the 24th of this month for Second Doctor, and details are out there for those who want to do a little walking around on BBC America's website and find out how our little frumpy grandpa is going to do.
Have they announced what the episode they're going to be airing is?
That I haven't found, and I was actually digging around for that today. I really wanted to know what they were going to use as their, you know, their standout episode. I've got kind of some theories about what they might use. You know, you've got some great ones that came along from there. You've got, obviously, the Ice Warriors. You've got a great installment with the Daleks from The Evil of the Daleks or The Power of the Daleks, which were great episodes for that. Mm-hmm. There's also The Tomb of the Cybermen, which could be an interesting episode to tie into, because again, you know, I think they're always somewhat cognizant of what they're teeing up for future episodes. So like to keep things, you know, keep the interest level high. Mm-hmm. Not like they need it, but
yeah, I haven't put too much thought into it, but actually I think Tomb of the Cybermen is probably going to be what they wind up going up with.
Could be.
And you got to think what they're doing is pretty much trying to, I mean, in essence, it's like, hey, look, you know, there's who that came out before Matt Smith. You know, here's some of the others. So they're basically trying to give you tastes and tidbits and little pieces of each Doctor so that you understand who each one of them is, as well as trying to draw in new people that really don't know anything about it. Hmm. So, I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, then, yeah, I think Tomb of the Cybermen is probably going to be one of the better choices for the Second Doctor.
Could very well be, yeah. So that's, again, that's something to look forward to on Sunday, the 24th? I think it's a Sunday. I have a calendar in front of me at the moment, but so we got that one. And then, speaking, you know, I just referenced it a second ago, but hey, you know, Jay and I gave ourselves a little pat in the back. I am like 2 for 2.
You guys definitely called it.
Yeah, that we will be seeing the return of the Ice Warriors. And now the question becomes, in Gaddis's script here, whether, and it's one of the things that we'll be talking about tonight, since we're talking about villains who have made the jump from classic Who to modern Who, is the revisualization of some of these villains along the way, and how to get away from Yeah, we had some extra foam batting laying around and some rugby pads and a couple of other things. Mm-hmm. You know, some cricket padding that we stuck all over these guys and painted them gold and came up with some villains. The Ice Warriors were not, in their early iterations, the most attractive villains on the planet. So I'd be interested to see exactly what they're going to be doing with them this time around.
It's funny that you say that the most attractive, because the article that we linked with that has a quote from Caro Skinner that says they were such a beautiful original design and genuinely really scary.
Okay. Well, looking at it with those eyes, you know, that's the same reason why we look back and say, man, I'm telling you, Tron, the original Tron was such a great film. It doesn't hold up.
No, it really doesn't.
You're looking at it through your childhood eyes. I'm sorry.
I think that the concept of the character and what it looks like they were visualizing is awesome. The way that it actually went together in the costume department, not so much.
Well, working with what you had.
Yeah. And, I mean, like I said, I can tell where they wanted to go. You know, you can kind of tell the feeling that they were going for. And had they had unlimited budget and resources and things like that, these guys would have been awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can understand what she's saying in that aspect. As far as actual physical appearance on what made it onto the tape, no. Sorry, that's a bridge too far for me.
Well, so that's something that we can look forward to when that episode airs for the latter half of Series 7.
Yeah.
All right. Now, Jay, I know you got excited about this one. I'm going to give you this next one to play around with.
All right. It's amazing how as soon as you throw a title onto something that, you know, as soon as you associate something with something that you like, it automatically makes it more desirable. I'm not a big food guy. The only thing I know how to make is ramen. You know, I get worried about making Jell-O because I'm afraid I'm going to burn it. But as soon as I saw that they are coming out with a Dining with the Doctor cookbook, I instantly wanted to buy this. Yep. I mean, it looks like it's just, I mean, it's regular kind of stuff. You know, but it's
inspired
all
inspired by.
Yeah, it's all given a Whovian twist. Like, what are some of the dishes here? There's the TARDIS Wellington. Baked Hath, the open-faced Dalek Ironsides, the Santaran soldiers. So, I mean, you can tell what they're going for. You can tell what it is that you're going to be getting. But, I mean, these are just some hilarious titles for them.
Yeah, and they've actually done very well with these sort of thematic cookbooks in recent years. We've had ones from Game of Thrones. We've had Lord of the Rings cookbooks. We've had Star Wars based cookbooks, and all of these things that
I mean, it goes everywhere. You get Harry Skyrim, Potter. Harry Potter.
Oh yes, yeah. Absolutely. Still haven't found a butterbeer recipe that I'm happy with, but that's another story. But the whole idea is that you're taking what are credible recipes to begin with and either just making a slight change to the presentation or maybe a little bit of a prep and ingredient tweak to tie them into, you know, something thematic and still be good.
So according to an official summary, it says, put on your fez and straighten your bow tie. You own a cookbook now. Cookbooks are cool. I mean, they've got a link right here. You can buy it on Amazon. It's $20. They've got a Kindle version, which I'm sorely tempted to get, which is $6.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not expensive, and it looks like it's, you know, the little Dalek sandwiches look great. I mean, some of the stuff, it's just hilarious. They've got a little, what are those rice ball things that they have? Anyway, it's, designed like a Cyberman. So it's
I love playing around. I know that you admittedly you're not much of a foodie. I am. And I'm big on presentation. As far as I'm concerned, I'm still of the mindset that presentation is 50% of the meal. Mm-hmm. So anything that you're going to be doing, you know, I've got a summer hoopla that I try to pull together regularly that all centers around the undead. So the idea of having you know, brain cupcakes and lady finger sandwiches and all the things that go along with that. That's all key. That's as much as how it tastes is the fact that you're getting that great experience. So hats off to these kinds of thematic cookbooks. Mm-hmm. I'm in. I'll buy it.
So the next story that we've got here, it's kind of a bit of non-news, but apparently the Sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, his daughter got into a little bit of a car accident.
Did you see the car?
Well, she hit a pothole, which made her swerve and go off the road and plow into a tree. Yeah. And now Colin Baker is saying that he is planning on suing because of the pothole.
Right. I'm going to call shenanigans right here and say, with no disrespect to our beloved doctor, his 22-year-old daughter to spin out of control and wrap this Nissan around a tree. I mean, you look at what's left of this car, and it's redonkulous.
I'll accept the story that she hit a pothole. I mean, there's nothing saying that she didn't, but for you to hit a pothole and lose control that much and be able to still do that much damage, she had to have been going, like, excessively fast when she hit that pothole. The pothole was not the problem. It was just the catalyst.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, I wish I remembered the reasoning, but I took a couple of law classes in high school, and there's, like, they need someone to sue if there's a pothole, and, like, the insurance companies know that and all that stuff. So even if she was going fast, like, eventually someone was going to sue them about that pothole. So I think that this is I think Colin Baker said if her insurance doesn't sue, I'm going to sue. So I think the insurance would sue in this case anyhow.
Yeah. I don't know. They already had the area sort of cordoned off, but the hole was kind of larger than the area that they had cone protected. And so she must have been like, either she was running over cones in the process or just blasting right through the dam. There's got to be more to this. I don't personally care what the story is, but the whole thing just makes me laugh because that's one hell of a pothole.
Yeah. It strikes me as funny that this would happen to Colin Baker, who is, you know, the least liked doctor, and every story that we've run into for the past couple of years of him has been something like, you know, when he was on the reality TV show and was causing problems on there, and when he, you know, with this, it's like, it just, everything is just kind of like, really, dude, really, we already don't like you. Don't give us ammo.
What else we got, kids?
There's a new BBC drama showreel that's come out. It's about 2.5-3 minutes, I think. And there are a couple spots in there that actually have new footage from Series 7B.
Okay.
Yeah, so I, from what I saw in that, there was a clip of the Doctor and Clara getting, like, caught together. It looked like maybe they had been kissing or something. I don't know. And what else did you guys see?
There wasn't much. I mean, they put everything in there, you know. So, I mean, there's stuff from Sherlock. There's
that was all I cared about.
Yeah, I mean, seeing Sherlock stuff kind of excited me too. I was like, oh, Series 3. But you know, it's at most there's like, you know, a second or two of stuff. It's just,
oh, there was Clara praying. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's, I mean, nothing really definitive, nothing that gives us anything, but when you have such a dearth of information, something like this is just, yay, more stuff. So.
I need more definitive things to chew on. I can't get to the point where I'm going to start doing screen captures and frame-by-frame walking to see. I've never been to that extent.
I didn't freeze anything. I just watched it through. So
yeah,
it's just,
my inability to recall.
It's just a fun little video in case, you know, you need to kill a couple minutes and you've run out of cat videos.
He's never run out of cat videos. Anyway.
Yeah. So we talked about this last week about Matt Smith being in Ryan Gosling's movie and the possible implications that might entail. And Stephen Moffat has come out and said that Matt Smith is not going anywhere. The fact that he's filming this movie is not a not an indication of anything. He said it, as soon as he's done with that, he's going to be coming back to film Doctor Who. So, yeah, I mean,
we didn't say that it was going to be this film that took him out of it. It was just that it was going to, you know, be the beginning of the end.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah, like, we're not expecting him to come out and say, okay, yeah, well, you guys know he's doing this movie, and you've all been speculating, I'm going to confirm that. Of course he's not going to say anything. It's going to be a big press announcement when it comes, when it happens. You know, or maybe not. Maybe they'll try and cover it up, God willing. But, you know, it's this is pretty much standard. I expected him to come and say something like this if he said anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. We'll keep open.
Yeah.
So, and then the last little bit that we've got here is nothing major. It's just officially confirmed now that the Neil Gaiman episode is going to be called The Last of or The Last Cyberman. So.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
it's fine.
What? What do you got?
No, I'm just, okay, great. That's like them coming out and saying, we're going to confirm that we are actually going to broadcast a 50th anniversary special that you've all been planning for and already taken time off work to see.
Yes. Now, the funny thing that I saw in this article was actually Neil Gaiman on Twitter said, now that everyone's reporting the working title of my next Doctor Who episode is news, I've just had an idea for a better title. I was like, well, you know, that's, of course that's how it's going to work out.
Called The Wrath of Khan. Well, we got plenty to sink our teeth into here tonight. Mm-hmm. We, you know, looking back on the breadth and scope of all things Who, we could talk villains for
50 years.
Countless hours, yeah, but we wanted to try and narrow in on some of the representative species, individuals, categories that have had a resounding impact on the show, past and present, or ones, even in a couple of cases, ones that have been more recently introduced that just have that degree of cultural groundswell. That really get people talking about it and incorporating it into fan fiction and t-shirts and Twitter fodder and all the things that we love to get, you know, sort of geek crazy about. And I'm kind of glad we end up with the ones we did tonight, because I think as a primer or as a way to get started, each one of the three species, I guess we'll call them species, that we zeroed in on tonight have some really interesting aspects to them that you might not pick up on at first glance if you really look at them just at surface level.
Yeah.
So, you want to do these in any particular order?
No, I mean, like, just the order we got them on the page, I guess.
Cool.
So we're going to start off with the Santarans. Now, these guys have been around for a while and have arguably had one of the largest, I'd say, evolutions of any of the classic Who villains. Mm. I mean, you know, you've got the big ones, the Cybermen and the Daleks, who are exactly the same today as they were when they were first introduced.
Sure.
Yeah. The Santarans have made changes. I mean, in their tone, their appearance, everything. They have altered and they have adapted, and you know, it really shows when they come on screen now.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of those changes being for their own interests, and others as a result of the situations that they've been placed into, or what has been forced upon them as a result of, you know, victories or losses along the way. You know, first exposure that we had to them, you know, back in the Time Warrior. So we're going back to what, 19. Oh God! This was Third Doctor. God, I can't even recall at this point. But we end up with the situation where we're in medieval England, And of course, so you've got all these knights in full armor and regalia, and they happen to come across one knight who seems to be predominantly more talented and mysterious because of his choice of weaponry. So this Lynx, as he's named, finds himself stranded in the Middle Ages here, and ends up. We start getting our first exposure to the sort of the mindset and the core principles of what makes a good Suntaran warrior.
This was actually the first appearance of Sarah Jane, wasn't it?
Yeah, I have not seen this episode, and I tried to. I looked for it everywhere. I looked for it on Netflix, looked for it, and couldn't find it. So I had to just read up on it and a couple of other things on the wiki. And it does say on the wiki, this is the first appearance of Sarah Jane Smith.
Yep, and it's what one of the really interesting things about this is in the midst of the episode, and broken into its four parts or so that it is, I think in either the second or the third installment, there's a point where Lynx, the Suntaran who is trapped in this medieval period, is Sarah Jane is brought to him, and he uses his mind probe of sorts to try and get information out of her, and she explains who she is. She's a reporter, and one of his questions is how did you get here and who did you come with? And she just says, came in a machine with a scientist, and so she's still processing everything that she's been exposed to as far as what the TARDIS is, who the doctor is, and so forth. So it doesn't provide Lynx with enough information to start to really realize what he's up against or what he's delving into. So it was really kind of an interesting breaking into for both this villain and for this companion, because they're both playing this piecemeal game where they're trying to figure out the backdrop of everything that they're confronting. I was actually... take the rest of the episode out of it because of the fact that there's some really, really bad medieval acting in here, and there's some kind of really bad sword play and whatnot, and then there's the... they actually convince the Suntarans to start building them these robot knights initially for amusement, but they get the idea that they want to use them as weapons for a while. And so you've got this scene where they've got this suit of armor that's clanking its way around a courtyard, and they're shooting arrows at it and so forth and laughing about the fact that it can't be stopped. But for no other reason than just the introduction of a very, very young Sarah Jane, you gotta love this episode. And Melissa, I'll get it into your hands, because... We'll take care of that on the QT.
Yeah.
Let's see. Suntarans appear again a little while later in the Suntaran experiment.
Yeah, the fourth Doctor episode.
Yep. So little bit of a change in appearance. Their makeup is starting to get a little more down there. But we've got them as a futuristic Earth scenario. Where they are now at a point where they are starting to capture Earthlings and study them, so they're snagging our astronauts. These are your recurrent monster of the week sort of episodes, but each one seems to be very consistent. We start seeing first appearance in the Time Warrior, it's a single Suntaran. Mm-hmm. Then we get a handful of them that are involved in the Suntaran experiment because they're trying to discern the viability of the human race as a threat or as whether or not there'll be an easy takeover. Every time we start to see them along the way in subsequent episodes, we start to see a larger and larger view of the scale of their empire. And their view of military conquest and military prowess. So definitely they must have made a good impression in their initial airings of the fact that they were going to be a good force to be reckoned with, that warranted bringing them around again in larger and larger capacities for the Doctor to contend with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then we we see them again in The Invasion of Time, the Two Doctors, and then finally in New Who in the Santarin Stratagem and the Poison Sky. So yeah, they just keep popping up every now and again. Before we decided to do this and before I started looking into it, the only classic episode that I really knew was the Santarin Experiment. That was the only one that I had heard of that I was familiar with. I really had to look into it and find out where they originated from. So,
right.
You know, clearly not a overwhelming presence, but still something that stuck around that people did remember.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So. Now, there's, as we were alluding to here, there's some aspects of the nature of Santarins that make them, you know, sort of iconic and interesting to us. They have always sort of equated them as far as their love for battle and their love for conquest and their feeling that the greatest thing to do. The greatest way to die is to die in battle with your teeth bared and your enemy, with your hands around your enemy's throat as they throttle the life out of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's Klingon. I'm sorry. That is your warrior class. So these are your, potato headed Klingons. So instead of your wrinkle heads, you've got these giant potato headed morons.
Yeah.
But there was some decision somewhere along the way, even after Tenth Doctor refers to them as, quote, finest soldiers in the galaxy. Their ability to strategize, their sheer numbers, their determination and passion for warfare, and their diligence and determination to see their cause through to the last breath. In fact, they would be glad to give their last breath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gave them this gravity.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, the thing that I pick up on is the fact that he did refer to them as the finest soldiers in the galaxy, not the finest warriors. I mean, there's a big difference there, and you can see it with these guys. These guys do have soldier mentality. It's, you know, they're willing to lay down their life for the mission, not accomplish the mission by whatever means necessary.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a difference there, and I mean one is more dangerous than the other, but they're both deadly. So, you know, just the fact that they are not the greatest warriors in the galaxy, the fact that they're not, you know, top dog, doesn't make them any less of a threat.
Mm-hmm. There may be some sort of an ethical nature or a code of conduct that goes along with being this great warrior. Mm-hmm. I think along those lines of the code of the samurai and that sort of thing. There's this principle or these these boundaries that they work within, whereas a soldier follows orders, carries out orders, whether or not that doesn't question orders. So at that point, are they the lever or are they just the hammer at that point? So, but where do they decide to throw the switch and they become Strax? to the point where if you see a Santarin in modern new, especially as we just saw with the snowmen, it's complete buffoonery.
Well, and I think that it was kind of a natural progression with Strax himself. You know, when you first introduce him, no Santarin would abandon his post and, forsake his orders to go help the Doctor unless he had nowhere lower to go. You know, you've got the Santarin who is horribly disgraced and is meant to, help the wounded instead of giving them a glorious death in battle.
Punishment.
Yeah. So he's being punished, and he's like, I can't go any lower. I've hit rock bottom. The Doctor's calling for me. Screw it. I'm going. And then, you take this, this person who has been, raised his entire life to be this certain way and stick him into a situation that's different from that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's comedy right there. You know, that's the basis mm-hmm. of situational comedy.
Yeah. Well, there was actually, you did actually have some Centaurans appear in the Sarah Jane Avengers. Mm-hmm. Which it's been a little while since I've gone back and do a rewatch of those. I've got them sitting over in the shelf, and I should have grabbed those as a quick brush up. But there was, because of the fact that was more of a young audience oriented program, you know, not necessarily a kid show, but I'd probably call it more so that than anything else. That the Centaurans did have a lighter hand as far as the way that they were treated as a villain, and there was a bit of that kind of a, if I remember correctly, there was a bit of that kind of a jest made at the fact that they were sort of the blind faith soldiers, and they could be easily confused or distracted off of the point because of the fact that they didn't really reason terribly well. They just had their marching orders, and they carried them out regardless of whether or not it did them in the end. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was one of the earliest grains that kind of led to something like the Strax outcome.
Yeah, and I mean we're not complaining. I think that Strax is a hysterical character, and I love him. I think that it was fantastic putting him in. It would be very easy to overdo it, so I pray that they kind of keep him sparse in the coming season. But you know, the if you get a little bit of him from time to time, it's great.
And we will see more of him. We know from some of the casting decisions that have been made is that we have definitely not seen the last of Strax. So I'm hoping we haven't seen the last of the Centaurans at all. And more so than just the, you know, ooh, we've gathered this room full of all of your worst nemesis over the years, and the kind of the Pandora approach where, you know, everybody's all clustered together, and you're lucky if you can make out a couple of the heads in the crowd.
Yeah, no, I would like to see a Centauran central story, mm-hmm. you know, and see them as actual villains instead of comedic relief. Or actually, I think it would be very funny to have a, you know, Centauran army as the villain and actually have Strax be on the Doctor's side.
Right, because in fact, he has really been isolated. His punishment is severe enough that it's kind of like you know, the kitten that has left the litter and is not allowed to pack again because he's got the wrong scent on him at that point.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, I would like to see that. You know, and as funny as Strax is and as much of a humorous character as they've made him, you know, when the snowmen start attacking, you know, Strax gets down to business and he has that place locked down and under control. That's when he is in his element and you realize, okay, this guy is funny and they use him for that reason. But he's still a Centauran. He's still got this stuff ground into him from birth. So, you know, he's still a force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think they've overdone it with Strax. Like, I don't want to say he ruined the Centaurans for me, because I actually like him as a character. It's just, I'll be happy to not see the Centaurans for a while.
Okay.
Which I know is not going to happen, but...
We're going to see Strax. I don't know if we're going to see the Centaurans as a whole.
Gotcha.
We might just see the one character and then fade into obscurity, maybe, but who knows?
Yeah. Let's see. There is a lot of additional content out there, though, if people want to be able to pursue that, especially in book form. It seemed to be a lot of the authors along the way for the spinoff novels that wanted to run with the idea of the backstory, going back to, you know, the origins of General Sontar and how the whole race of clones started. So, you know, there is some interesting stuff back there if you want to dig through it. It's just a little hard to track down a lot of the publications at this point. I haven't really looked for them electronically, but I know in print form, you're going to be digging through some dusty stacks to try and find some of these. But, you know, do a little legwork. And if you find copies, I'll give you my postal address in a heartbeat. So.
All right. Well, so the next race that we decided that we were going to look at is the Silurians.
One of my personal favorites, actually.
And, you know, Kieran and I were talking about this before we started recording, that the Silurians have really I have a hard time labeling them as villains. I mean, clearly that's the role that they fill, but I don't feel that they're villainous. I don't feel that there's anything about it. In every last one of their stories, it's basically people coming in, messing up their stuff, and they try and defend themselves.
Or factions, or I should say, groups of their race who, during some sort of, you know, millennia-old diaspora that's scattered about the galaxy, are returning home again, expecting to find their home world, only to find it occupied by these bald apes that have taken over. So they consistently not only have gotten sort of the short end of the stick in just trying to defend themselves and their own, but there have been instances in almost all of their appearances where they've been willing to sit down and compromise and come to terms with the situation at large. And due to circumstances, things go pear-shaped and battles have to ensue.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
were they like that, though, in the earlier? Because I have not seen the Silurians, the Sea Devils, Warrior of the Deep.
I actually just rewatched these recently. I took a scan watch through the third Doctor, the ones from the 70s, the Silurians and the Sea Devils, because the pacing on them was extremely slow. But by the time you get around to the Peter Davison, you know, Warriors of the Deep and so, you end up with these instances where, all right, take the first one, the Silurians. You've got a matter of, similarly to what we know from the modern Who, it's an expedition where, you know, during cave study, they come across, the Silurian race, and they end up in attempts to study one another, you know, capturing, you know, one of the human spelunkers, so to speak, gets captured and accidentally killed, and it sparks off a lot of you know, tension on both sides. And we get to the point where we understand Silurians have been there far longer. Homo reptilia were potentially the rightful, you know, evolutionary progression for global master species, so to speak, but as a result of being driven underground through environmental reactions and ice ages and things like that, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But you end up with this opportunity where you can have negotiation and mediation, and the Doctor is trying desperately through both of those first two encounters, the Silurians in 1970 and the Sea Devils in 1972, to try and find a peaceful coexistence, and it keeps going wrong. And the Silurians are willing to and even attempt to work with him, but because you've got these gun brandishing military types on the human sides of things that don't want to wait for this. You know, they're creepy looking, they're freaky, they've got third eyes on their heads, and, you know, and they keep killing, innocent farm people, you know, because they're being driven to the surface. It never works. You get to the Fifth Doctor with Warriors of the Deep, which is set deep in the future at this point. You've got one of the colonies that went off into space that is now attempting to return, and gets intercepted by a human, scientific study. But funny enough, they're scientists with guns who don't give them the opportunity to try and sit down and negotiate. And the Doctor, Davison at this point, is Fifth Doctor, desperately tries to ensure that they have the opportunity to do so, and as a result of circumstances and this sort of a race condition with all these Silurians of the Silurian triad, as they refer to them, you know, this last great group of thinkers and negotiators on behalf of the Homo reptilian, they're getting killed off as a result of they're being deprived oxygen and things, and they're doing all these things to kill them off. And it's actually one of the doctor's own companions who's responsible for killing the last one before they have an opportunity to salvage this situation. So again, just another example of them, you know, getting stuck in the wrong place, the wrong time, and us just being the, you know, the chest pounding monkey men who don't allow them to have this, to find this. I kept coming across, and it was actually a phrase that was used in a couple of episodes. In fact, and I haven't even really rewatched some of their better exchanges in the more recent episodes in terms of The Hungry Earth and Cold Blood with Matt Smith. But the idea of the phrase peaceful survival versus militant reclamation, you know, this idea of can we coexist, or do one or the other species have to completely wipe out the other in order to even remain? You know, it's this polarity that always seems to surround this particular species that makes it kind of tragic as far as I see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've really been able to explore a lot of the topics that they can't with races like the Daleks or the, you know, the more monstrous villains and things that, you know, these are creatures that we can sympathize with. That, you know, they're close enough to humans that we can project ourselves onto them and therefore explore these things that we wouldn't be willing to with some of the other villains.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a lot more depth in these guys, depth of character and story than you can with some of the just the always hostile and never varying villains that you get.
How often do you get to actually understand the other side of a genocidal argument? Or maybe not understand, or maybe not agree with it, but at least understand it. I mean, that's what makes for a really complex conflict.
Mm.
Because now you're looking at it and saying, "Well, holy crap!" So now I've got these two sides that are at odds with one another to the point where they're willing to take each other out to the last breath, but they both have their cases.
And that's a far more realistic storyline in terms of things that actually happen in the real world. I mean, how many times do you run into a conflict and someone's like, well, you know, I was attempting this and there was this problem and whatever, and they just came in and started shooting, and then you go to talk to the villains and they're like, yeah, no, I just felt like killing all these people. No, I mean, both sides have their reasonings and both sides, you know, seem very viable to those sides. So this is a much more realistic thing in where both sides have motivations that can be seen as the correct one from their point of view.
Hmm.
So,
which is what makes it really interesting to me now with some of the recurrences and the reappearances, and I'll tip a hat a little bit to Badger for insisting that we discuss this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last mentions that we had outside of the snowmen and that appearance. Is the referring to the Silurians as a race, another one of these colonies on their return with their arc during Dinosaurs in a Spaceship.
Right.
So you've got this group of them who were completely wiped out on their own craft, their own vessel, by Solomon.
Mm.
Not to sort of jump villains here. But interesting that we looked at that and said, you know, oh, Solomon's a right bastard because he, you know, he completely wiped out this race of creatures or this group, right, of creatures for sheer greed.
Mm-hmm.
That we had trouble with. But the whole idea of the Silurians saying we're willing to wipe out the face of the earth to reclaim the face of the earth as ours, we don't have as much trouble with. Interesting that they keep using this species around these larger issues and topics of discussion.
And then,
Solomon is a right bastard.
Yeah, very much so. And then, you know, the fact that every other time we've seen the Silurians as a race, not individual ones, but, you know, there's always a kind of feeling of these are the bad guys. You know, there's always stuff going on in the background and things to make you question that, but there's always the, this is the villain of this story. Whether they're truly villainous or not, that's up for debate, but you know, that's always the role that they fill. And in this one, as soon as we see them, we're like, oh, cool, the Silurians. And then you find out what happened to them, and you're like, oh, man, that is wretchedly horrible. You know, and there's, I mean, there's actual, like, sorrow that goes into that, because you know that they don't deserve it. And it's just, it's, it was interesting to me to see them no longer portrayed as villains and actually to be, you know, something to be grieved over.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever really saw them as outright villains, because in all of those instances, they were either trying to make sense of what the intrusion was, or they were attempting to return to what they thought was home. You know, they never had that sort of a militant intent. They were not like the Sonorans in that regard, or definitely not like the Cybermen or Daleks, because eradication was not their primary goal.
Yeah, no, they wanted their home, and they wanted to be left alone, and that was basically it. And, I mean, who can fault them for that?
Mm-hmm. And you're right, they cast them as the villain in episodes where you need, you know, some pushback, but they're never, I've never thought of them outright as a villain, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then one thing I wanted to bring up, and that, like you said with the redesign aspect of the Ice Warriors, is these guys went under a radical redesign from Classic Who to New Who.
Yeah.
Matt Smith even makes reference to it in The Hungry Earth when he first sees them, and he's like, oh, Silurians. I missed the third eye, though.
Yeah.
I didn't even catch that.
Yeah,
when you see them in the 1970s or so, they have this this third eye. And in fact, in a lot of the scenes where you're seeing, as they love to do, they would see a human getting attacked from the point of view of the villain. Mm-hmm. So they turn the camera around, and they would do this sort of a filter trick on the lens to give a three appearances, so you're seeing it through three lenses on the screen, so that you could say, "Ooh, I'm looking trioptic. How cool is this?" kind of thing.
The third eye was mainly for like infrared, wasn't it? Or
yeah, it was this glowing kind of thing. It would pulsate with their speech, you know, as they communicated and so forth. By the time you got to the fifth Doctor, they really. Yeah, their look was not really evolving terribly well. You had the Silurians themselves kind of looked like the Swamp Thing to a certain degree, with some sort of fin projections off the back that were definitely more fish-like than reptilian.
I was going to say, it looks almost like an Oriental interpretation of Swamp Thing.
Yeah, yeah. You ever played Legend of Zelda?
Oh yeah,
the original Zelda, and you had that thing that always popped up out of the water and shot a fireball at you, and had the big kind of fishy mouth. There you go. That's another Silurian. And then, but the funny thing was that when you had the Sea Devils episodes that had to do with a sort of a related race, a cousin race that were subterranean, subaquian to go along with the subterranean Silurians. And they decided they were going to band together for their own self-preservation. The Sea Devils looked like giant snapping turtles. Literally, their heads were turtles mounted on these giant cowls that sat over the head of the guy wearing the costume to make them 7 feet tall. So you had these ET necks and these turtle heads. I'm like, guys, you got your species all mixed up here, because the one that looks more reptilian is being referred to as a sea devil. The one that looks more like a fish is being referred to as Homo reptilian. Just, you got to get your stuff straight. So apparently when they were sitting down to script The Hungry Earth, and Steemo and Pierce Wegner at the time decided they were going to give Chris Chibnall the opportunity to start penning this one. All they said was, we want to bring back the Silurians. We want them to be awoken as a result of some giant drill that's tapped into one of their colonies, their subterranean colonies. And he started working with it. Moffat said, "Well, okay, I want them to be more expressive, because all their previous mask work and makeup work, you barely got any jaw movement, so it couldn't have looked more mask-like if you tried. So we need to do something with prosthetics that's going to make it much more expressive and make it easier to tell principal characters apart. Mm-hmm. And in that process, somewhere along there, they decided they were going to drop the third eye routine. And people actually got kind of snippy about it. Surprisingly enough, a lot of critics decided they didn't like the redesign, and they wanted them to be these, trioptic lizard people.
I mean, it is a big change. They don't look at a thing like it. I can see why people would get mad.
I can understand it, but at the same time, it's with the way that they've been portraying them in the new series, instead of being constantly vilified and things like that, and they're trying to make them more closely associated with humans, I completely understand making them look more human. And actually more reptilian as well. So I love the redesign. I think it looks great. Maybe if I had seen the classic stuff beforehand, I might feel different, but the third eye just doesn't seem that important to me. And you feel like these are much more relatable characters with the makeup instead of the masks.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right. So
we definitely have not seen the last of them because we know, obviously, with all of our involvement with our lovely Madame Bastra along the way. The species and the idea of that has been has been left on the writer's table to date and will continue to. So I got a feeling we will see the species as a whole in a larger capacity. Maybe not remainder of the series, but I think they're becoming a go-to.
Yeah.
Same as the Santarans. We know we'll see Strax again. We'll know we'll see Vostra again. And you can just hope that we actually see more Silurians.
Yeah. And hopefully in a more alliance-oriented stance instead of someone to be overcome or calmed down or something.
Mm-hmm. So. All right. And to end on a big note.
So this is the only one that hasn't come from the classic series. This is a new villain, and yet obviously one of the most popular is the Lonely Assassins, or better known as the Weeping Angels. These guys were first introduced in the episode of Blink, which, ironically, the way that this episode played out was that Stephen Moffat had been given a couple other episodes to write, and things kept coming up, and he kept having to put them off, and he felt bad about it, and he finally was like, okay, I need to make it up to these guys. You know what? I'll take the episode without the Doctor, because no one ever likes to write those episodes. They're hard to write, so he was like, I'll take that one as punishment for putting this off. And it has become one of the most popular and most loved episodes ever, and the Doctor's in it for, maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me personally, did either of you guys ever see the show Eerie Indiana? It was on in like the 90s, I think.
Disney Channel or something, right?
There was an episode, and this is a journey, walk with me. There was an episode where the main character's best friend and he were both interested in this girl, and he wound up getting killed, and she had heart problems, and so she got his heart as a transplant. Well, he also gave her a locket, and so anytime she would kiss the main character, her heart would start acting up. It was the other guy trying to interfere with it, basically. Anyway, so at the end of the episode, she puts the locket around the statue on this guy's grave, and she's like, I can't have you interfering with me anymore. And the statue on this kid's grave was an angel. And as she walks off, there's a close-up on the angel's face, and a tear actually comes out of the stone. And it creeped me out so badly as a kid. I mean, it just terrified me. And then, fast forward, 20 years later, here I am sitting watching Blink, and there are these things called Weeping Angels. And it just, it evoked that fear in me. And so these things get to me probably more than they should. But, I mean, these are probably the scariest things I've ever seen on Who.
I'm trying to find it. There's a quote by Stephen Moffat about the real, where the inception of Weeping Angels came from. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it came from the childhood games, which actually some of his creature developments all stemmed from that.
Yeah.
I found the quote. This is what I found. There was an abandoned church with a dangerous graveyard. Yes, dangerous. Officially dangerous. The gates were chained up, and there was a big sign saying, "Keep out, dangerous structure." Well, could you have resisted? I went and peered through the bars, and there, among all the ancient leaning gravestones, was the statue of a lamenting angel. The way it looked at me, I felt sure this was the dangerous structure in question, a dangerous statue hidden in a graveyard. A few Christmases later, long after Blink, we were back at the hotel. My son Joshua and I went for a walk past the church, and it all came flooding back. "Hey," I said, "want to see the original Weeping Angel?" I took him to peer through the bars of the damaged graveyard. "Dad, there's no angel there." There wasn't. There really wasn't. We left fairly quickly. And that is Stephen Moffat in Doctor Who magazine, February of this year.
Excellent. But he decided to pull on the sort of the premise of what we here growing up in the States might have a game like Red Light, Green Light.
Mm-hmm.
Over in the UK, they refer to the game as like a grandmother's footsteps, where, you know, you can only take steps forward when grandma is not watching you, sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. But it's that same sort of the premise. And I think what makes them, from a cinematographic standpoint, so particularly terrifying as hell is the fact that it only takes a split second to have it, you know, encroach upon you that much more and become more and more vicious and dangerous with every step.
And the fact that it's, you know, all you have to do is blink. It, you know, it's an involuntary reflex. It's something that you almost can't stop yourself from doing, and that's all it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, Stephen Moffat is great at evoking those primal fears in us. You know, you look at the Vashta Narada, the Silence, the Weeping Angels. It's all something that's a primal fear and something that's almost incontrollable, and turning it against us. You know, and that's what makes these villains that he comes up with so great.
Mm-hmm. I think both one of the aspects that interested me and kind of bothered me at the same time was where we really started to get to, like, Time of Angels.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole Angel Bob thing, right, speaking through their recent kills and that sort of thing. And the idea of projecting themselves through visual representation, through images and things, you know, going through video screens, and infecting Amy Pond through what she had seen and what was on her retinas. That started to kind of... I tripped over it on first watching, mm-hmm, and by second and subsequent watches, I wasn't happy with it. It's not one of my favorite decisions with regards to what I've done with it.
It really took a lot of the fear out of them for some reason. I mean, I don't know exactly what it is that made it less scary, but it was like... okay, yeah, here they come. All right, run. Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, I mean, Blink, they were terrifying. Yeah. And as scary as they looked, because they were all degraded and damaged and things like that, they weren't as scary in Time of Angels. Mm. They really weren't. And, you know, part of it was the fact that instead of, you know, just zap, you're gone, done, never, you know, yeah, just a single touch and you're dead, they decided to start snapping necks. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's not how they kill. And, you know, I heard something that kind of helps to assuage that, in the fact that these guys were very, very weak, you know, to the point of almost being dead. And then in The Angels Take Manhattan, if you remember when the angel has River by the wrist, she says something about, like, you know, I don't know why she didn't send me back. And the doctor's like, she's weak. She doesn't have the power to. Well, so sending them back, while that's their primary source of feeding, you know, that takes energy. which these guys don't have. Instead, they have this ship that if they can gain access to, they can eat all they want without having to expend that energy of sending someone back.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes more sense that, okay, I need to get rid of this guy, I'm just going to snap his neck and go eat. Instead of, do I have the energy to expend so that I can get energy from him? Or, you know, so I can kind of understand why they went that route instead, because they had an ample food source waiting for them, and they didn't really have the reserves that they needed to really take on this group of people in that aspect. So It kind of helps make sense of that a little bit. Still, it would have just been much simpler not to change them.
I think they were trying too much to be like the Vasta Narada. Remember the Silence in the Library, where they had the... Because they mention it in the episode,
right,
Time of Angels. Those things were that kept their consciousness, you know?
Yeah, where it was able to take the victim's voice and use it against them.
Yeah, so, I mean, just suddenly making the angels able to do that, I just felt out of the blue.
I would have preferred if they had reused the Vashna Narada. You know, stick with that. Keep your villains with the same MMO. You know, don't try and change them midstream and completely ruin it. You know.
Right. Well, that's whereas the angels have a strategy and they have a reasoning for their self preservation. The Vasta Narada were essentially just, you know, the as they were referred to, just the piranha of the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was strictly feeding.
Yeah.
And going after it, you know, regardless of any pattern or strategy, which I guess, again, it kind of goes back to the whole idea of you know, the angels know when they're getting weak, they know when their power is limited, they know when they have to bide their time and wait for the next opportunity. It's the idea of, like, the angler fish that sits there and dangles that out to wait for its victim, whereas the Vasta Narada would just kind of lunge at any opportunity, whether it be a human leg or a chicken bone that's thrown into the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. That's
it's yeah. It seems less intelligent too. The Vasta Narada, angels are very intelligent.
Yeah. I would definitely have not seen the last of them. Because they are easily, I know, with all of the internet polling that had been done about, you know, who's gonna win the villain fights, going back and forth. You'd have all the brackets for the competition. The angels are always in the final, you know, if not the final showdown, they're in the top four.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that says a lot about them, though. Even though Moffat went all George Lucas on it and tried to ruin them. The fact that they're still one of the most favorite villains, and only having what, four episodes behind them, I mean, they're not like any of these other villains that have, you know, years of history. I mean, these guys have been in four episodes, and yet they are one of the top ranked villains ever.
You're never going to see them in any sort of alliances either.
Mm-mm.
It's just not in their nature. They have no need or capacity to need to partner with anyone. So you're not going to have any of these sort of Pandorica situations where, you know, all of the villains gather on the surface of the planet to take down the Doctor. They're working strictly for themselves.
Yeah. Mm.
But I'm sorry. The babies?
Sorry.
The babies.
Creepy-ass
children.
And, all right, that's the thing. That's the first time we've ever heard an angel.
You know, mm-hmm.
The other angels don't make any sound at all. You know, they might steal a voice here or there, but they never make sound.
Mm-hmm.
The angel or the little cherubs were, you know, I mean, that was them laughing. It was like that.
They're inexperienced.
That added a whole new creep factor to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was. Actually, I went down to the Alamo recently, I don't know if you guys have ever seen downtown San Antonio. There's this area called the Riverwalk that, you know, has a lot of stuff that's been there for a while and everything. There was one point where I was walking through this narrow alleyway kind of thing, and I heard this child out on the street laughing. And it scared the crap out of me. You know, because it echoed down the alleyway that I was in. It was just, I was sure I was going to wake up in 1940.
That would freak me out, too.
It was just the way that the laugh kind of reverberated off the walls and everything. It sounded exactly the same, and it scared the crap out of me. Because, there are a lot of statues and stuff down in downtown San Antonio, and, you know, clearly now they're able to actually infest other statues.
Yeah, and that's...
Yeah.
That leads me to think, you know, are we going to have some future episodes set in Rome? That's just what we need. Take me to some place where we've got a ton of architecture and
The problem I have with it is the fact that it's, you know, the initial introduction says that, you know, they turn into stone to defend themselves. Not that, you know, they take control of a statue to use as armor. It's the fact that this is their form when no one's looking, and when someone looks at them, they become stone. So I have a problem with the idea of them becoming something other than their original form. Or is it the fact that they take on all kinds of human shapes and whatnot, and that the angel is just, you know, the most popular body style?
I mean, that's a good question. It's annoying because we learn something new about the angels every time we see them, and it's something that...
contradicts something.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I feel like it's not even worth asking the question, because there's just going to be another episode coming up that'll completely rewrite their whole story.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that bothers me. I'm like, you know, these were such a great villain in Blink. I mean, they were perfect. You couldn't have done anything to make them better in my mind. And every time we see them, they try and add a facet or change something just a little bit, and it takes away from what they originally were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, aside from the little creepy baby laugh.
Interesting. I'm looking to see what kind of accolades the species has gotten over time, and we're discussing all the polls that were done. Mm-hmm. The BBC did their own independent poll by way of their Doctor Who Adventures magazine, wherein the angels were voted the scariest monsters of 2007. Okay, 2007, so we're right around Blink, with 55% of the vote. Seconded only by the Master and the Daleks, taking second and third place with 15 and 4% respectively. The Daleks came 4%, whereas the angels took 55% that year. Wherein in any of the previous votes that they had done through the magazine in years prior, the Daleks had always come out on top. So to knock them down below the Master, you know, and take tenfold their votes.
And to put that in context, though, I mean, did we have a Dalek story that season?
2007.
I know they popped up at one point. They have to contractually, but. I don't think there was a Dalek central story in that in series 3.
No, not in 3. Had them in 1 and 2, they were more predominant than 3.
Yeah. So I mean that might be part of it, is simply the fact that we haven't seen the Daleks in a while, but here's this really scary villain that we just got introduced to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you were to ask the same question today, I don't know that there would be such a big gap between them.
Okay. Well, in some other polls, and this might be kind of telling for us for what we're going to be seeing down the road here as far as more recent changes with things, Neil Gaiman himself went through and was voting on classic monsters of sci-fi and fantasy in general, okay, and everything that he's written and been exposed to across all media and genres, and considered the Weeping Angels to be the third in far as his top 10 monsters of all natures. Interesting though, in the British periodical, The Telegraph, as far as ranking Doctor Who baddies, as they refer to them, the angels came in third, Daleks were second, the Nestine Consciousness, who we've just started talking about again, came in top, and we know that we're not done hearing about the Great Consciousness. because they've been starting to seed that considerably in very quiet, careful suggestions along the way of bringing that old nemesis back that seemed to be more pervasive under the surface of all these episodes, these scattered episodes, the way Bad Wolf used to be kind of scattered around. We didn't know what the hell was being referred to.
Are we talking about the nesting consciousness or the great intelligence?
No, aren't they the same thing, though? Or
there is a connection between the two, because you've got the nesting consciousness as being that disembodied intelligence that drives the autons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the idea is that that is part and parcel of what we've been seeing with the great intelligence as well in driving the snowmen, in most recent appearances.
Gotcha.
Give it a little time. A way to stitch it together.
Yeah.
But I also think, who is taking these polls that you were just talking about? Because it sounds almost like they're priming us for, if you poll the average Whovian, and they're not going to say the great intelligence is their scariest villain or whatever. Unless it's like the producers, like,
this is out of like the Telegraph and the British Intelligencer and some of the publications that have been kind of the cornerstones for water cooler discussions in the UK for decades.
I'm just saying it sounds almost like they're kind of priming us.
Well, and part of the thing that you have to do with, what you have to understand with surveys is you have to take in, the time that these things are done. Like with the first one you mentioned, if you take it when, there's a new scary villain that just came in, a classic villain that hasn't been around as much, you're going to see a disparity there. Even though the classic villain is much more popular than the original, or the new one, you have to understand, if they made reference to the great intelligence, that's going to be fresh in people's mind, and that's going to be one of the first things that they mention.
True. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I think the Angels started out as a very, very strong villain, and they've kind of waxed a little bit. We'll see if... I mean, obviously, Angels Take Manhattan was far scarier than the time of Angels in Flesh and Stone. I'm not sure if that was because of the angels themselves, or because we knew about the pawns. It's hard to say at this point, but it looks like they might be on the rise back up in terms of being a decent villain. So I don't know. I think we're going to see them again, and they're always going to be the central aspect of that story, because, like Kier said, they're not going to team up with anyone.
Right.
So you're not really going to get anyone else in there. It's always going to be the angels and the doctor. So, right.
Their only alternative is to have it sort of, multiple villains vying for the opportunity to take him out.
Or possibly the doctor teaming up with someone else because the angels are a greater threat than each other.
When they are at full energy, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. We'll see how it all plays out. Well, it's about time for us to wrap up. So, do you guys have any last words?
No, I'm glad we got a chance to do this. I kind of enjoyed some of this almost as much, if not equally as much, as going through some of the companion discussions, mm-hmm. because, you need the counterpoint in order to make the Doctor shine. So,
All right. Well, so next week we're actually going to be taking a look at the Silence. And we're taking a look at the religion as the whole, not the alien race that often gets called the Silence. I don't think they actually have been given a name, or maybe I've just forgotten it.
That reminds me, I got to buy another bag of Sharpies.
Go through them so darn fast.
I know. It's like full sleeve tattoos.
We're also going to be taking a look at some of the listeners' recommendations. So, if you have a villain that you want us to talk about, then go ahead and toss that in. Let us know on Twitter or email or however you want to get in touch with us. Let us know, and we'll take those in, and we'll kind of touch on those next week as well.
Mm-hmm. Again, the Twitter handle is @GallifreyRadio. Right. Make sure that people know what they're shooting for there.
Or email at GallifreyPublicRadio@gmail.com. You can also find each one of us on Twitter as well. So just, you know, however it is that you find us, get a hold of us, you know, comments, wherever you download this are a great way as well. And we really appreciate all those. They go a long way to helping us shape this into a show that you guys actually want to listen to.
Doing it for the kids.
Alright, well, this has been episode 25 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying Steemo's new villain is going to be based on the game Marco Polo.
And this is Melissa saying, good evening, I'm a lizard woman from the dawn of time, and this is my wife.
And this is Kier saying, I can produce magnificent quantities of lactic fluid.
See you guys next week.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week on iTunes or at gallifreypublicradio.podbean.com. Have something you want to say, or just want to say hello? Send us an email at GallifreyPublicRadio@gmail.com, or on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. We love getting comments, so head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating and your comment on the show. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict. Right. Well, this has been episode 24 of Gallifrey Public Radio.
25.
Oh, damn. All right, let me try that again. Damn it. All right.
And can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Wait, how about now? Is this okay?
No, now it's just a complete garbage. Absolute crap. Go home.
Can't tell if you're joking.